The dangers of the careless handling of germs, viruses and bacteria have been described in the recent book The Dangers of Epidemics from Test Tubes by Manuel Kuiper. On the basis of numerous scientifically verified examples, the author clearly shows that so-called biological safety procedures are not what they ought to be. For example, viruses serve as carriers of genetic components in genetic laboratories. On page 42, the author writes, "The significance and adaptability of viruses in the whole biosphere have long been underestimated. Norwegian microbiologists have found up to 250 billion viruses in a quart of natural water. Up to 70% of these viral particles infect bacteria, thus causing a significant transfer of genes into the environment. Considerable amounts of loosened genetic material in concentrations of 5 micrograms per quart were found in flowing waters. Where these genes come from is almost totally unknown. Against all expectations, these free genes remain in the environment, bound to soil particles for days, weeks and months on end. Microbiological work. The handling of free nucleic acids and their genetic manipulation in thousands of laboratories, causes new genes to be spread and released into the environment. Thus, environmental pollution from genetic engineering is unavoidable." The author also describes in detail the possible tainting of pharmaceutical products that have been manufactured with manipulated microorganisms or cell cultures. We quote, page 72, "What unpleasant surprises are in store for us from the area of genes, viruses and bacteria in the age of genetic drug production and synthetic substances occurring naturally in the body is exemplified by hepatitis outbreaks in England among cancer patients in 1986, on whom the genetically derived interleukin 2 was being tested. A particularly dark chapter in genetic engineering is its use in the manufacture of biological weapons. Since 1980, the American professor of microbiology, Curtis P. Thorne, has used genetic engineering to reinforce the anthrax agent. Professor Thorne and co-workers have supplied the Pentagon with manipulated anthrax germs and other germs which have been made resistant to antibiotics, like penicillin, agents against which the present art of medicine would be totally helpless. These are only a few of the examples from the well-documented research by Manuel Kuiper about the dangers of modern microbiology." Kuiper's line of reasoning continued, "Modern biotechniques have succeeded not only in transplanting individual genes into new environments, but also in completely dismantling genetic barriers. Genetic realms which have been separate for millions of years or thousands have been merged. Can we keep control of the development of the microcosm manipulated by man? If not, then evolution will strike back mercilessly and scourge us with new plagues." Next headline is, "The fight for the gene are the battle between light and darkness." We have to keep raising the question of why. Why do scientists do nothing to avert the unbelievable danger in which we find ourselves, particularly since such striking consequences are coming to light? Why don't the geneticists question themselves and their science? Do the scientists who work with genetic engineering ever have reservations? Do they read the published report? For instance, those that have been quoted here? Perhaps we need to go on the premise of an incomplete education. Highly specialized experts have been educated and trained, but they have had very little ethical and moral education. Ethical and moral values, a Christian foundation of life, are losing ground more and more. What we explained at the beginning of our book will, after the facts presented here, become more and more clear to many a reader. Therefore, we want to repeat, knowledgeable and responsible observers of the scene have come to the conclusion that a purely materialistic philosophy of science leads to such false results. Science views itself more and more as a science of engineering. Let it be repeated again, many medical doctors do not know there is a soul, or they act as if they didn't know. They do not take the soul into account, as a rule they see only the body. And the body is treated like a machine which simply has to function. Apparently, that the soul gives life to the body is not understood. Why is this so? In the final analysis, who or what is behind all this? These questions inevitably lead us to the battle between the darkness and the light. The demon state and its accomplices want to bring about the downfall, the eradication, of Christ and his own. Every single person belongs either to the light or to the darkness, depending on how he feels, thinks and acts. This is why genetic engineering and gene manipulation are virtually of a cosmic dimension. They are part of a demonic plan, in the truest sense of the word. The individual scientist, who is proud of his success in his particular field, presumably does not know that he is but a cog in this plan, a small mosaic tile in the great picture of the apocalypse. Each person can ask himself, whom do I serve? On whose side do I stand in this great battle of cosmic dimensions which is being fought on Earth? Am I a helper and servant of the darkness, of the demon's state? Or do I contribute in such a way that many hearts become filled with light and the kingdom of Jesus Christ can emerge? We can see where we stand in how we think and act. The person who thinks he can stay out of it, by avoiding a conscious decision, is already taken in. The decision has already been made for him, because he has handed over the control of his life. To whom? His thoughts and actions, his conscience, the finer feelings which signal his motives can tell him this. In the revelation that has been published as a book entitled The Demon's State, Its Accomplices and Its Victims, Christ explains what this is about. We need to recognize that there is only an either or. This means that if a person is not consciously oriented to the divine and if he does not receive his impulses from there, impulses which lead to a positive way of thinking and living, then he is aligned in his thinking and living with the non-divine, the demonic. With his negative thoughts, words and deeds, he supplies the demon's state with the negative energy that they need. He is a victim of the demons. On the other hand, he will also receive impulses from the negative forces, which stimulate him to continue to think and act towards what they want. In this way, he becomes an accomplice of the demon's state. Unknowingly, he carries out what the adversary of God wants to achieve through him. Considering this context, we can pose the question, could it be that such people, including scientists, for instance, they are already manipulated people who receive their impulses directly from the negative source of the demons? The demon's state is rallying all forces so that its realm, its demonic realm, is maintained, even though it is doomed to failure in any case. And with the scientists that are involved in these negative activities, we have to include the politicians and church authorities as accomplices to the demons, when they remain silent about these wrongs. Apparently they lack insight and a global vision. Many scientific projects are begun without questioning the consequences of such a venture. Just consider genetic engineering. The entire human genetic makeup is being analyzed, without questioning the purpose of this research and how it can be abused. The individual scientist seems to be blind or at least short-sighted concerning the contextual framework of his work and the meaning and purpose of his actions. Are there not powerful economic interests behind this, in which scientists become accomplices of these large industrial interests? Money rules the world. Can it be that scientists are no more than agents of big capital, to influence and manipulate people? Next headline is, Dangerous Prospects of Genetic Engineering. Influence on Longevity and Brain Development. There were many geneticists present at the annual convention of the American Society for the Advancement of Science in Chicago in the spring of 1992. Reports were presented about the genetic manipulation of fruit flies and threadworms. It was discovered that the life of fruit flies and worms could be practically doubled. This means that a gene has been found which influences aging. At that meeting, the American geneticist Johnson reported that on the basis of his research results, human beings could grow as old as 130 to 150 years. Presently, experiments are being carried out with flies and worms to establish the technical and scientific conditions for further research, and now they are trying to establish whether mice and men have similar genes. Spiegel magazine reported in its 496 issue that researchers on aging are presently directing their attention to a molecule from the nucleus of the cell which is celebrated as an immortality enzyme. Cell biologists are now attributing a key role in the aging process and the growth of cancer to this protein substance, which was discovered just a few years ago. The wonder substance has been named telomerase. We die because our lifespan is genetically programmed, so was the creed of aging researchers summarized by Carol Mullis, the spokesperson for Geron, an American biotech company. A gene chronometer in the cell nucleus determines how often the body cells can divide. Aging researcher Jerry Shea and his colleagues from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas have announced that the molecular life clock ticks in the telomeres, the end segments of the chromosomes. A very small DNA fragment is repeatedly strung together on the telomeres of the chromosomes of the cells of infants. Shortly after birth, they begin to disintegrate. The researchers have discovered that every cell division causes the telomere to shrink by about 50 DNA components. After 80 to 100 divisions, the life elixir of the cells has been used up. According to the cell biologists' theory, this slow erosion of the telomere limits the lifespan of man to a maximum of 120 years. Shea is collecting evidence for this theory. Thus, cells whose telomeres he had artificially lengthened lived about 50% longer than untreated control cells. Another group from the universities of Freiburg and Mainz has examined the development of the brain of flies. Genes have been found which influence very specific brain structures which control the development of specific areas in the brain. Based on these examinations, scientists hope to be able to establish how brain development can be influenced. One could counter that what is possible with a fly will not necessarily succeed with a human being. We know, however, that everything that has been tested on animals will, with high probability, one day be applied to humans. Unfortunately, this is the experience history teaches us. Interference in the brain means switching programs on and off in the human brain. The result is that a person would no longer be able to follow his own life program, but one that has been forced upon him. 130, 140 years with or without a brain, a such a person is simply being controlled. He no longer knows himself, he does not live himself, instead, he is merely a tool without a will of its own, a robot. The soul of such a person is spiritually dead. It vegetates a dull, apathetic, paralyzed, bound, burdened. The divine light, which deep inside never quite expires, is barely a glimmer. The consciousness has become so narrowed that it is below the spiritual consciousness of a stone. Through the prophetic word, we know something about the lifespan and deathspan of human beings. The human being is given a certain lifespan, a specific amount of life force and a series of life programs. The predestined time span for his physical death lies within the so-called death span, during which time death occurs, at the latest towards the end of the death span. At that point, the life programs intended for this incarnation have run their course. So a soul without programs, a that is, without communication, and no longer has the magnet that draws it to Earth and to its body. Nothing holds the soul here, it can no longer live in the body, because life is communication. The person would have to die, to discard his body, so that his soul is free for its continuing journey. In this connection we have to ask, when a human body is kept alive longer than is intended according to the spiritual laws, can it still be the same soul which uses the body as a house, as a vehicle? Another question. If the soul is kept in the body and is kept alive longer than its foreseen death span, whose programs does it live, since its own have run their course and it therefore has no programs, no communication of its own anymore? Who is inside such a human vehicle of flesh and blood? Who lives it? Who moves it? Who acts through this person? Who speaks through him? Whom do we meet in him? Will the new world order be realized through humans like these? The Nobel Prize recipient for medicine, Max Delbry 1/4 CK, once formulated the power of science in the following way: early on I noticed that a scientist can change the world more than Caesar or any other field marshal. And while he is doing it, he can sit perfectly quietly in a corner. The arrogance of a human being who no longer acknowledges God as his creator and wants to create an order according to his own human and intellectual concepts becomes clear from the remarks of the German geneticist Professor Gassel of the Technical University at Darmstadt. Genetic engineering allows us to produce every genetic program as DNA elements in any amount and to determine its informational content through sequencing. Just as with a construction kit we can change living beings by the insertion of small or large DNA elements, the evolution of the species has not defined those which are beneficial nor those which are harmful. Only man has sorted living beings into moral categories for his benefit. Comments such as this allow us to recognize the self-concept of geneticists. It is really a matter of creating living beings and altering them according to a human criteria of values, of usefulness. In the end, won't the decisions be made according to economic and political points of view? Jeremy Rifkin wrote in his book Algenie in 1983, "Two futures beckon to us. We can choose to engineer the life of the planet, creating a second nature in our image, or we can choose to participate with the rest of the living kingdom. Two futures, two choices. An engineering approach to the age of biology or an ecological approach. The battle between bioengineering and ecology is a battle of values. Our choice, in the final analysis, depends on what we value most in life. If it is physical security, perpetuation at all costs, that we value most, then technological mastery over the becoming process is an appropriate choice. But the ultimate and final power to simulate life, to imitate nature, to fabricate the becoming process brings with it a price far greater than any humanity has ever had to contend with. By choosing the power of authorship, humanity gives up, once and for all, the most precious gift of all, companionship." And from Rifkin's book, Declaration of a Heretic, "Once we decide to begin the process of human genetic engineering, there is really no logical place to stop. If diabetes, sickle cell anemia, and cancer are to be cured by altering the genetic makeup of an individual, why not proceed to other disorders? Myopia, color blindness, left-handedness? Indeed, what is to preclude a society from deciding that a certain skin color is a disorder? In fact, why would we ever say no to any alteration of the genetic code that might enhance the well-being of the individual or the species? It would be difficult to imagine society rejecting any genetic modification that promised to improve, in some way, the performance of the human race. The idea of engineering the human species is very similar to the idea of engineering a piece of machinery. An engineer is constantly in search of new ways to improve the performance of a machine. As soon as one set of imperfections is eliminated, the engineer immediately turns his attention to the next set of imperfections, always with the idea in mind of creating a perfect piece of machinery. Engineering is a process of continual improvement in the performance of a machine, and the idea of setting arbitrary limits to how much improvement is acceptable is alien to the entire engineering conception. Whenever we begin to discuss the idea of genetic defects, there is no way to limit the discussion to one or two or even a dozen so-called disorders, because of a hidden assumption that lies behind the very notion of defective. Ethicist Daniel Callahan penetrates to the core of the problem when he observes that behind the human horror at genetic defectiveness lurks an image of the perfect human being. The very language of defect, abnormality, disease and risk presupposes such an image, a kind of prototype of perfection. With human genetic engineering, we get something and we give up something. In return, for securing our own physical well-being, we are forced to accept the idea of reducing the human species to a technologically designed product. Genetic engineering poses the most fundamental of problems. Is guaranteeing our health worth trading away our humanity? Next headline is, Reawakening Ancient Genetic Material Paleomolecules. Genetic engineering does not stop with human beings. Numerous logical reasons can be cited for this. Is it only the epitome of a researcher's blind drive when DNA molecules that are thousands of years old are reawakened? The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung of April 1, 1992 printed an article entitled On the Track of Ancient Genes. In July 1992, in the professional journal Spectrum of Science, an article was published on the same subject entitled Trends in Molecular Anthropology A Paleomolecules. A Swedish researcher had succeeded in isolating a bit of genetic material from a well-preserved Egyptian mummy and multiplied it in bacterial cells. Thus, for the first time ever, a researcher cloned an ancient DNA molecule and revived, so to speak, a 2,000-year-old piece of genetic material in bacteria. By way of the chemical duplication of genetic molecules which takes place in a polymerization chain reactor, PCR, it is now possible to copy and multiply bits of genetic material from parts of a body, at times even from fossils and no matter how old. The headline Neanderthal Gene in the professional journal Spectrum of Science reported that numerous projects were underway to analyze the genetic material stemming from the earliest stages of human prehistory. It seems that some researchers want to extract genetic material from the bones of prehistoric man and examine it. Using ancient human DNA, for instance from Neanderthal man, anthropologists will be able to verify several theories of human development directly. The Atilder Zeitung, German Physicians Journal, reported on May 12, 1992 that American molecular biologists have succeeded in isolating pieces of genetic substances from bees which had been trapped in amber for millions of years. The researchers were astonished at the size of the fragments that they could isolate. The purpose is to find well-preserved bits of genes in suitable fossils or amber pieces. These endeavors were superficially explained away as basic scientific research. What really lies behind all this? What motivates a scientist to this? What forces and energies are behind this kind of research? A book published by Universal Life entitled His Eye, The Bookkeeping of God. The microcosm in the macrocosm can give us some answers. We read in this book that the cherished wish to be a successful inventor and researcher, a desire perhaps maintained over many incarnations, A opens a person for inputs from the worlds beyond which are able to control him via his thoughts. In this way, interest groups of souls, but also demons, can use the person as a tool to achieve on earth what is in their plan. The person usually considers the ingenious notions and ideas he implements as his own. Can this be the case here? Apparently the demons, in ever more desperate straits, exploit every opportunity to activate a negative potential for their purposes. And so, through people A who on the basis of their personality structure are amenable, that is, controllable by them, A they try to tap into the energy potential of ancient high civilizations. We know about the rise and fall of civilizations throughout the ages. What started out positively, with perhaps an orientation toward the divine, could not continue to prosper at its peak, often because the life of luxury and hunger for power enticed people to forego their high ethics and to give in to the temptations of the darkness. The demon's state then saw to it at first hardly noticeably, but then ever more boldly, A, that the high divine principles of life were reversed into their opposite. In this way, the positive energy potential of divine power which had been built up at the beginning was reversed, transformed down into negative, demonic energy. With the collapse of such civilizations as that of ancient Egypt, Atlantis, and others, large reservoirs of negative energy remained in the atmospheric chronicle, which the demons, as a last resort, now want to make use of. They want to achieve this by bringing back to life preserved genetic material. There are only limited possibilities left open to the darkness, for there is hardly a supply of positive energy left in the four realms that can be reversed for its purpose. This is why the darkness relies on shifting negative energy around. Everyone can decide for himself whether he wants to consider these correlations or not. If we accept them, then the uneasy feeling increases that these experiments are highly dangerous affairs, with unimaginable risks, with an enormous potential for misuse of inestimable consequences. Nevertheless, it will turn out differently, for God is and remains the Almighty. He sees everything and knows very well how to guide matters. It will be as it has been revealed. The world may come to an end. Everything that has not been built in the name and with the high power of God, but the kingdom of peace will emerge on an earth that has been cleansed, and everything that has fallen will begin its return to the pure being. Next headline is, Are Mankind and the Individual on the Road to Servitude Under the Demons? Let us briefly summarize. The new world order that is planned needs an environment and people that function. In the final analysis, one can assume that all genetic research has been initiated by those who proclaim the New World Order. Much indicates this, because all alterations of creation, carried out by people at the present time, have as their goal to prolong human life despite the less bearable conditions on our disturbed and destroyed Earth. We have already pointed out that it was the same power structures that were responsible in the 60s for the nuclear program and, in the last decade, for the Star Wars program and that now influence the research of man's genetic code. It is this same political power which controls the military and now the development of molecular genetics, too. As mentioned before, underlying all of these efforts is a plan of cosmic dimensions being carried out by the demons state by exerting influence and control over people. In this way, the demon wants to seize, to safeguard and consolidate the ruling power on earth for himself and finally, to declare victory over God. Final seizure of power for the demons this is how they are spinning their webs should be by way of control of the human brain. This will be made possible with genetic manipulation. What would the reprogramming of our brains actually mean for us? Couldn't one see it as something positive when in the future, for instance, we no longer have sexual offenders, or when the activity and dynamism for work in certain areas of life would be stimulated, that is, when useful programs in the brain would be activated? Wouldn't it be worthwhile to strive to program people of the future genetically to ensure their peacefulness? The spiritual point of view gives us an entirely different perspective. Let us look once more into the correlations of the causal law, the law of cause and effect. In the Bible we can read, "You reap what you sow." The law of sowing and reaping, the causal law, still holds true for all people and souls. Everything that is not divine, which we have caused by our sensations, feelings, thoughts, words and actions, is our seed. These are the causes which do not disappear with time, either because we do not, or do not want to, think about them, or because we can no longer perceive them. Our negative seed are our unkindness, our self-centeredness, the mine and me, the striving for wealth, power and prestige, our sins all remain with us. Unerringly, the part corresponding to each individual is stored precisely, in his brain cells, in his soul, in the repository planets of the material universe and of the purification planes, as well as in his genes. The law of cause and effect, of sowing and reaping, the great causal computer, brings our causes into effect at a given time. We then have to suffer what we have caused, and dissolve it by recognition and expiation. This is the justice of God within the causal law which we have created and which will hold true for us as long as we do not actively take the path to the heart of God, which leads us into the law of heaven, into selfless love. It would be a long way home for all souls, full of sorrow and suffering, if the way back to the divine were possible solely through expiation, according to the principle of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But God has placed His grace above His justice by sending to earth His Son, Christ, who lived and taught the law of love and who, by the "it is finished" on the cross, placed His light, His power, in our hearts. This is now a support, a guide and help on our path home to the Father's house, so that we can again unfold our spiritual heritage. His grace is an increased release of divine energy for those who, during the moments of the day, recognize their sins, their seed in their hearts, not with their mind, their intellect, but in their feelings grasp them and feel remorse, ask for forgiveness and forgive, and then do not commit the sins any longer. Then, through the redeeming power of Christ, the negative is changed into positive energy, which carries the person forward and strengthens him, so that he can continue to recognize and clear up more. From then on, he fulfills the laws of God, the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount, instead of his base humanness. This is the path of Jesus of Nazareth to the Father, the direct and shortest way, which saves us from their long, hard, tortuous path of expiation and sorrow. This path depends on our self-recognition, on the recognition of our causes and on the repentance of our wrongdoing.